Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe's podcast, Shameless Popery. He recently did an episode on Halloween, which gave us one of the things that has happened year after year here at Catholic Answers, long before I ever got here, is in October, we begin to get questions about Halloween. And it has actually gone down in recent years. We're getting fewer Halloween-related questions, but still, the questions will be about, is it okay to celebrate? Should we avoid Halloween? What should we do instead if we're not? And is it evil? Is it demonic? All that kind of stuff. And so Joe actually did a really interesting thing on it, and I wanted to talk with him about it. And Darren is super smart. He goes, let's do a poll and see what people think. And so we have the poll results. I can give you the poll results now. Joe, are you ready for the poll results?
I'm doing a drum roll on my table. The microphone's probably not picking it up.
It's not picking it up. You have noise reduction on. But anyways, hundreds of people voted. A smaller number voted on YouTube than voted on the app. So let me give you the app first and then the YouTube, and we'll see if we have two different crowds there on those two.
Ooh, interesting.
But the app, okay, so here's the question. Halloween, it's good, clean fun. That's one choice. It's a doorway to the demonic. That's another choice. It's not demonic, but I don't like it. That's another. And then finally, other. And the winner is, let's start from the bottom. The lowest is, it's not demonic, but I don't like it.
Not that interesting.
That's the curmudgeon. Oh no, I don't want to insult people, but that's the get off my lawn version. Answer.
I don't want to insult people, but they need to stop listening to our show right now.
Yeah, right. But I'm now going to be mean to them. No, it's just in play. It's just in fun. I think people. Oh, actually, that group probably doesn't know it's just in fun. Sorry. I apologize. All right. Then there's a tie. This is on the app between other and it's a doorway to the demonic, and that's at 20%. That's a tie for second place. The winner is at 43%. It's good, clean fun.
Nobody has a majority. How many votes is that?
Hundreds and hundreds. That's all I know, Joe.
Okay.
Hundreds of votes. I don't even know if I can say hundreds and hundreds. I'm not exactly sure. But all right.
Okay.
You want to hear what the answers were? It's not at all the same on YouTube. Halloween. The lowest one. 9% of people on YouTube said it's a doorway to the demonic. All right.
Okay.
Not demonic, but I don't like it. That's 14%. Other is 17%, and there's a clear majority, 59%. It's good, clean fun on YouTube. So what is the correct answer, Joe? Do you have a correct answer?
Yeah, I mean, I would be either in that camp or the other camp. Because, look, there's obviously ways you can celebrate Halloween immorally. You know, you can you can get drunk, you can wear things that are immodest, you can do any number. But I mean, look, people do that on Friday nights, and we don't say, therefore, Friday night is sinful. Right.
Like, that's a good point.
People go out to the bar, and they get drunk, and they wear inappropriate clothes. And, you know, people will take any celebration and will corrupt it for their passions. That doesn't mean the celebration is bad. So I would say, yes, there are obviously ugly ways you can celebrate Halloween. You can celebrate it in ways that celebrate the occult, and don't do that.
I have to say, just so you know, Joe, on the app, because we like to, you know, give mm-hmm. bonus features to the people who got the app, if they chose the other category, they got to tell us what they thought. And the majority of people there said, it's not demonic, but it's often people act out demonic thing. Like, it has that. So that is what you just said, that I don't like it because people use it as a doorway to the demonic, or
right.
treat it as a doorway to bad behavior, but or the demonic. And so I don't like it. So that's that. What you just said was quite common in that response.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, we have smart listeners. There is a popular theory that Halloween comes from an ancient pan-Celtic pagan festival called Samhain, spelled like Sam Hain. And none of that appears to be true. It's a very popular myth.
Well, first of all, was there any pan-Celtic celebration? I mean, like, the Celts does that even exist? It seems like something people made up.
Yeah, so if you go way back, like more than 2,000 years back, you could probably talk about a unified Celtic people in the center of Europe. But the Celts are spread to the four winds. And so, like, when St. Paul's writing to the Galatians, those people are ethnically Celtic. But they're in modern-day Turkey. And they're Christians who used to be Roman pagans. They're not celebrating Samhain. They're not doing any of these things that are ascribed to them. The holiday of Samhain, which, as near as we can tell, just means summer's end, and there's no evidence of, like, particular religious rituals tied to that day, we only get from Irish evidence, which is a tiny corner of the Celtic world. So it would be like saying, people in the Americas all celebrate Cinco de Mayo. And it's like, no, that's like a weird group of Americans who think it's a Mexican holiday. It's not like festival.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then, like, in addition to that, like, not only is there not a single Celtic people, they also don't have a common calendar that has October 31st / November 1st. They're not on the Roman calendar. The calendars we have of the pre-Christian era, because the Roman calendar shows up at the same time Christianity does, in Northern Europe. And before that, they're using like lunar calendars, and saying that this is going to be always on October 31st misunderstands how a lunar calendar works. It'd be like saying Passover is always on, April 25th. It's not. It moves around on our calendar because we're using different calendars.
Yeah.
So all of the kind of myths you may have heard about Samhain are fictional, as far as we can tell. Now, was there a day called Samhain that was the day that people gathered together after they were done harvesting and they celebrated? Yeah.
Maybe.
Were there religious celebrations associated with that? Not that we know of, but maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems like we've taken Labor Day and tried to turn it into something scary and demonic, because that's kind of what we got going on is Irish Labor Day.
And it's Irish Labor Day, but Halloween is actually a Catholic festival.
It's not a Catholic festival.
We took a pagan holiday and we made it Catholic. That's not actually what happened.
No,
it has nothing to do with October 31st. Right. It's all about November 1st, and it is the eve of an actual very ancient. As a matter of fact, I defy anyone to tell me when was the first All Saints Day celebrated. A long time ago, long before anybody remembers.
Yeah. And I mean, the date moved around on the calendar and you had different dates on the calendar, but the November 1st date was from Germany or from like Northern Europe, not in a Celtic area. So even the placement of Halloween as the eve of All Hallows or All Saints Day is not a response to this imaginary holiday called Samhain. Or an appropriation of it, or a, Christianization of this pagan holiday. It's just two unrelated things that happened to be on the same day. So, yeah, a lot of the kind of mythology around Halloween is just that. It's just mythology. So then the question is like, okay, so we've got these two great back-to-back feast days, All Saints and All Souls. And so the mind is naturally drawn between that and the changing of the seasons to thoughts of death. Is there a way to kind of acknowledge that and even celebrate that in a way that isn't overly macabre or occult or anything like that? And I would say there certainly is. Whether people do that well or not is a different question. I mean, likewise, like, I'm a big fan of celebrating birthdays. Do some people overeat and overdrink? Sure. But that just means do it better. That doesn't mean don't do it at all.
All that being said, I have to say that I want to confess that my take on Halloween is it's good, clean fun. As a matter of fact, we had a slight altercation about this in our studio meeting this morning, because John and I disagree with this. John Brasillo hates Halloween because he's got six kids and it's just too much to try to get costumes for everybody. But I
that should be a good argument against back to school also.
Yeah, right.
Like, argument against getting new shoes for six people.
Yeah. But here's the thing that I honestly, this is my honest belief about Halloween, is we are such an isolated in the house. We don't talk to each other society. On Halloween, people visit each other's homes. Now, you could complain about that. You could fuss about that. That, to me, is an unmitigated good. You say, oh, well, we're teaching communism. I've actually heard people say that. We're not teaching communism. That's not, the communists don't have
private
a thing where you go.
Private charity is kind of the antithesis of the communist system. But yeah, right. go ahead.
Like, that's not how communism works, so that's not what we're teaching. It's fun. Yeah. It's just people having fun. Putting on, little kids get to dress up as superheroes or whatever, and they come to your house, and you give them stuff, and it's fun, and you tell them how sweet they are, and they're... And, you know, there's a lot of bad that goes with it. But the fact that we visit each other's homes, I wish we had a holiday like that every month. I honestly believe we would be a better society if we had some reason to visit each other's homes every month.
And can I throw out a thing? So last night, my wife, after Mass on Sunday, two things happened. I found out that one of the local stores had a deal on 50 cookies. And I thought, what do we need 50 cookies for? And I mentioned this to my wife, and she said, I was hoping we could do a party getting ready for All Saints Day and for St. John Paul II's feast day. So last night for the feast of JP2, we had several of our friends over, and I think there were 11 adults and 19 kids. And it was good, clean after-dinner fun. We had cider and cookies, and then we picked names of saints out of a bucket to ask for their intercession for the next year. And so everybody, you know, adult and kid alike, got to choose names. And yeah, so if you want something, like if you're disturbed by the commercialization of Halloween or by an overly like dark twist to it, I would throw that out there as a way that you can celebrate and still have the kind of social aspect, whether that's on Halloween or whether you do that on All Saints Day or whenever. Because I agree. I think we need more festivity. I think we need more getting together with the neighbors. I think we need all of those things that have been all too often missing. And if we're so worried, like, what if my neighbor celebrates in a way I'm not comfortable with, then we end up, I think, retreating into a kind of isolation that isn't godly and isn't healthy.
Amen. All right. Well, thanks to everybody who took our poll. Check out what Joe had to say about Halloween on his podcast, Shameless Popery. You can go to shamelessjoe.com to find it out. He probably will, if I let him, he'll recommend an episode on Trent Horn's podcast. But
you're like extremely offended. Like, why would we?
You think my
Trent
podcast
Horn
is good? You should see Trent Horn's podcast. Also, I would just like to say, 11 adults, 19 kids, 50 cookies. That means some people only got one cookie. Right back with more Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilino with a few words about St. Augustine. St. Augustine's achievement was monumental. He invented the genre of autobiography. He wrote classic, foundational texts on morals, the theology of the Trinity, the theology of history, the interpretation of Scripture, and many other subjects. He negotiated or argued several major heresies into non-existence. The Catechism cites St. Augustine more often than any other writer outside the Bible.
All right, back to the phones. It's Ask Me Anything. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Joe, how many cookies did you get? How many did you get? How many?
There might have been three over the course of the whole night. I was having trouble getting rid of them.
I'm sure. With 19 children there, it was like, who's going to eat these cookies? All right, Shannon is in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, watching on Facebook. Glad you're here, Shannon. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, guys. So my favorite Halloween costume by far is St. Denis. I saw a thing on Facebook about that, and it was
holding his head.
By far the best one. Yeah, well, it was they made it so it looked like it, you know.
That like he was holding his head.
I'm glad they didn't actually. Yeah, that'd be a commitment.
Anyway, so Joe, I wanted to thank you because in part Catholic Answers and you, Joe Heschmeyer, are in part responsible for my conversion to Catholicism I was baptized and confirmed in the Catholic Church last Easter. And so I just
Welcome
wanted to
home.
Thank you for that. Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
I was a Protestant all my life, and the other caller was talking about Mormonism. My mom baptized me in the Mormon Church when I was 7 years old. Wow. And then I was more of a Baptist Protestant the rest of my life. And then you know, I came to the realization of the early church and other things, and, of course, Catholic Answers and Shameless Popery had a lot to do with that. So thank you.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's wonderful.
So
I'm very grateful to hear that.
Yes, thank you. So my question is, so I had a discussion with a Protestant fellow, and he was trying to say that there were bishops of Rome after St. Peter, but there was no cohesive papacy or church in the early part of the church, and that the papacy only existed after Constantine. And that the early church really didn't recognize the seat of St. Peter. They did their own thing. And I tried to argue on grounds of how the early church dealt with heretic and other things collectively, but to no avail. So I'm just kind of curious how you would respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about the claim is he's specific, right? He says Constantine. And so we know that at least in the 300s. And so then I would challenge him, like, what kind of evidence would it take to see prior to the 300s that would disprove that theory? Is he open to being disproved on it? And the reason I challenge him on that is there's very clear evidence on the special role of the Bishop of Rome and the Church of Rome well before Constantine. But I think sometimes this myth that this is all like an invention by Constantine is so deeply embedded and is based on, as far as I can tell, literally no evidence, that when you throw out the evidence, it can feel like just throwing evidence into a void. But let's talk about the evidence a little bit. So first, let me ask a question, if I may. So it sounds like he at least acknowledges that the early church had a structure of one bishop per church. Is that right? So he doesn't object to the episcopacy, he just objects to the Pope?
Well, I mean, he knew that there were many bishops of Rome, and I tried to say, look, I mean, there were, you know, 20-some bishops of Rome from the time of Constantine prior, and that didn't face him. And I said, look at all the different bishops. Look at how they dealt with heretics. Look at, you know, even in the Bible, it gave the authority to St. Peter. And he still didn't want to acknowledge that. And I'm like, okay, where do I go with this? And I was trying to think, well, where do I go to point to how evidence historically in the early fathers' writings of where they turn to the Holy Father?
Yeah. Well, a good place would be St. Irenaeus of Lyon in about 180. So, you know, about 100 years before Constantine is even born. In book 3, chapter 3. Part 2, or like paragraph 2, he talks about how he can trace the apostolic succession of any of the major churches, but he chooses to trace it of the Church of Rome, because this is the church founded by Peter and Paul. And he says, quote, "It is a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority." That's all you need for the papacy. Like, I have to agree with what the Roman Church says, because it has a preeminent authority. I don't agree with it because I happen to agree with it. I don't agree with it because it's my favorite bishop. That's not it. It has a preeminent authority, and therefore, you have to obey. That's 180. Right. This is literally the same document that tells us Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels. This is the earliest known evidence showing those, and only those, are the four Gospels. And so that's super early. Now, there's no reason to believe he's the first. He's not saying, hey, I've got this crazy new idea. We should all follow the Bishop of Rome. By the time he's writing, we're already on the 13th Pope. And yet this is just something that he's only mentioning this almost in passing and explaining why he's looking at the popes rather than, you know, the bishops of his own diocese in Lyon, France. And he's from Smyrna in the East. So this wasn't just like a Western thing. He's an Eastern father who's a bishop now in the West and is talking about this special role that the Pope has over the whole church. So that's the kind of thing that it sounds like your friend claims doesn't exist. And yet here it is. Like if somebody said, you know, cars didn't exist until the 1970s, it should be enough to point out like, hey, look, here's Rebel Without a Cause. That guy has a car. And, you know, like that should be enough. You should only need one example. We could multiply those examples. We could look at the role, for instance, Clement plays in First Clement. But if the claim is that this didn't exist till the 300s, then seeing it obviously existing in the 100s should be, I think, a pretty strong disproof. By the way, have a book where I talk about this in a chapter called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. So I would be happy to send you that. But did that answer your question?
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yes, and do you by the chance have a video on that, on this whole, on this particular topic, on shameless popery?
I bet I do. don't remember the title of it offhand, but this is a topic that I love talking about. So I bet if you looked up shameless popery, bishops, something like that, you'd probably find something. And I'll look after this, and if I don't, I'll make something soon.
That would be so awesome, and I love you guys, and I've learned so much. I was shocked when I converted about how much I did not know and how much was held for me. I had no knowledge of the early church history, none. And, yeah. I mean, I knew I had a pretty good foundation of the Bible, but, you know, my eyes just opened, and I was instantly a convert. So I was a convert Beautiful. Even before I walked through the doors of my parish.
Wow. Well, God bless you. Sounds like God was really at work in your life.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Hang on. We'll get an address from you. Thank you very much for the call. And wonderful to hear from you, Shannon. Up next, Matthias in Houston, Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Matthias, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me to call. Thank you very much, Joe, for your very cohesive videos, and Sai for being an amazing host for us tonight. So,
thank you.
I've been after having discussions with a friend who is an atheist. We've been speaking about Isaiah 52-53's rabbinical interpretational history, pretty much. So, trying to understand this prophecy and not trying to deny the fulfillment of Jesus, is it honest to believe that Isaiah 52-53 is speaking of Israel and not denying Jesus as the fulfillment?
So I don't think it makes sense to view the suffering servant as Israel. Mm-hmm. If you look at all the suffering servant prophecies, if you take just Isaiah 53, mm-hmm. you can make the argument that it is Israel and Jesus. But if you look at the rest of the suffering mm-hmm. servant prophecies, that interpretation is a lot less plausible. I'd say also, as far as I know, the idea that the suffering servant is Israel itself is a much, much later rabbinical interpretation. Like, it is after mm-hmm. the time of Christ, and in no small part, mm-hmm. a response to the fact that Christians are using the fact that this is pretty clearly a prophecy of a suffering Messiah as evidence mm-hmm. that this is about Jesus. And so I would be very skeptical of that, kind of as an interpretation. I'll give another example of that. So for a long time, there was this argument that, so in Psalm 22, you know, the my God, why have you forsaken me psalm? In that, there's a line about how his hands and his feet are pierced, which sounds like crucifixion, which is quite striking because the psalm is written about 1,000 years before crucifixion. And so there was an early Jewish response that, like, no, this version isn't in our version of the Psalms. This is a Christian edition. But now we've found ancient versions in Hebrew that were Jewish in origin, and it's there. And so we know the Christians didn't add it. So I'd put this in the same category of passages that were used by Christian apologists for Christianity, and that then there was this kind of pushback against that of just removing them in some cases from the lectionary, within the synagogue lectionary, and then denying the way that they'd been historically understood because that way sounded too Christian.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Matthias, thank you very much. It's Ask Me Anything, and Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. I'm going to keep moving because we're getting there's lots of people on the line. Natalie is in West Virginia listening on Catholic.com. Go ahead, Natalie, with your question.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Before I ask my question, I wanted to thank you, Joe, for putting out the series on Mormon. I think I'm like the third person tonight who's mentioned it.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, they helped my best friend and I have a really great three-hour-long conversation with some Mormons
Wonderful.
A couple weeks ago.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
I'm very happy to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much. So my question is about craniosacral therapy. I know several good Catholics who practice it and other New Age practices kind of like that. And then another good Catholic friend has done some research, and she thinks that it's maybe like a gateway into the occult. And I was wondering who is right. Is it okay for Catholics to practice the New Age method?
All right, Natalie, we got to take a quick break. If you can hang on, we'll get you an answer on the other side of this on Catholic Answers Live. Many people have forgotten just how revolutionary the Bible creation stories are. But the first three chapters of Genesis are a powerful challenge to anyone in any generation who would undervalue human lives. In the Beginning, the new book by Monica Migliorino-Miller will take you on a fantastic journey through the first chapters of Genesis, unfolding the richness of life as God sees it. Get In the Beginning today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
When it comes to Catholic teachings about Mary, there's one question we hear more than any other. Where is that in the Bible? The answer? Everywhere. In Bible Mary, the Mother of Jesus and the Word of God, Father John Weiss opens Scripture to reveal a Mary who has been hiding in plain sight. Order your copy of Bible Mary today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
I'm Deacon Harold Burke Sivers. Join me for Beacon of Truth today at 4 p.m. Eastern.
On the next Beacon of Truth, talking fruits of the Eucharist and soulful Psalm 143.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest, and on the line is Natalie in West Virginia. Natalie's question involved the practice of cranial sacral therapy, but other New Age practices. And are these acceptable for Catholics, or are they in some way maybe a door to the demonic? Are they ways of are they illicit for Catholics? Did I get that about right, Natalie?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Okay, Joe, what do you got?
Yeah, I don't think that they are New Age methods. So the reason I'd say that is, now I'm going to caveat this and say I'm no expert in the area, but everything I know about it is that it's based on a theory of osteopathy about like the structure of bones and especially bones in the skull and connective tissue. So it might be right or wrong. Like it might be quackery. It might have a bad vision of like the nature of the body at a bodily level, but it's not working with like demons. It's not working even with like chakras or spirituality or anything like this. It's literally just trying to like do a skeletal kind of massage to relieve tension in the body. And nothing in that is occult, whether that's, you know, right or wrong. In the same way that if you had, I don't know, if you had like surgery or put your leg in a splint because you believed your leg was broken. Now, maybe the splint helps, maybe it doesn't. But you're not inviting a demon in just because you've done something to try to heal the bones. So I think this is one of those places where a lot of alternate medicine gets lumped in the category of new age spirituality. And some of it is, but a lot of it isn't and doesn't claim to be. And other parts can have validity, even if some of the original practitioners had a really weird view of the body. So to take the example of chiropractic medicine, the original theories behind chiropractic medicine are totally wrong. But some of the skeletal adjustments actually do provide people a real relief from pain, just not for the reasons that the originators thought it did. So you can take those good things without endorsing any view of spirituality or anything like that. And nobody I know is doing this. Isn't like Reiki or, you know, using, I don't know, like stones or anything in some weird spirituality ceremony. This is literally just trying to massage the bones in your head.
Natalie, what do you think?
Yeah, that makes total sense. I actually had, I thought about it in terms of chiropractor or chiropractic as well. So, yeah, thank you so much for that answer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Natalie, thank you. I tell you what, I'd like to send you one of Joe's books. I made you wait over the break to get the answer to your question. So how about, what would be a good, maybe the early church was the Catholic Church. How about that one, Joe?
That sounds good to me. What does that sound to her?
All right. Yeah. All right. Oh, yeah, I guess I could have asked Natalie. I don't know why I had to ask Joe. Yeah. Joe, what book would Natalie like? What? All right, Natalie.
It's like we're choosing you a birthday present, Natalie, but I don't know you, and you're on the line while we're doing it.
Hang on, Natalie. If all you have to do is give your address to Thomas, and we'll send you that book out. And if that's not the one you want, just tell him. He'll give you some other options. Bill's in New Mexico. Bill, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe. No, Bill? All right.
Hello?
Oh, there you are, Bill. Hi.
Oh, there you are.
Hello?
Howdy.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. As I told the screener, I'm a product of the Inquisition. I'm a Sephardic Jew. My family was crypto Jew for years and years, and until about 20 years ago is when we finally came out. We're part of a group called Ya No Estamos Escondidos, which translates to "We're no longer hidden."
And, wow! So for centuries, your family was Jewish and hiding it.
Yeah. So here in northern New Mexico, there's various signs all over the place of the hidden of the people that were hiding from the Inquisitions. Like, for instance, like if you go to the Santa Fe Cathedral and you look up maybe about 15 feet above the doorway, there's Hebrew letters up there. Nobody could see them, but they're there. I mean, they were, and there's just a bunch of different things like that. And I just say that because, you know, I was just wondering how is that justified that we were basically forced into Catholicism years ago in order to save our lives. And how does the Catholic Church answer to that? Like, what do they do?
Yeah, so I believe Chris Check has a series on the Inquisition that might be helpful here, because there's a lot of inaccurate history about the Inquisition where people have kind of a misconception of what happened and why and the scope of it and who was targeted. So, for instance, non-Catholics weren't a target of the Inquisition. Definitionally, the Inquisition only focused on people who claimed to be Catholic. Now, nevertheless, there were bad things that were done in the name of the Inquisition. There were bad things done in the name of the Church during the Inquisition. And Pope John Paul II in the year 2000 publicly apologized on behalf of the Church for what he described as errors committed in the service of the truth through recourse to non-evangelical methods. The point there being, it's good to fight for the truth, but it's bad to fight for it in a way that is contrary to evangelization. And so forcing someone, that kind of thing is totally contrary to that. So whatever form that takes, whether it's the Inquisition or any other time, if you're making someone pretend to believe something they don't, or, you know, physically harming them for believing the wrong thing, that's contrary to the evangelical calling that we're called to as Christians. So I think it's very clear, like, there were parts of it that were not excusable, that were indefensible, but also that the popular imagination has a totally skewed impression of what happened and for how long, and at the kind of the scope and scale, it's much smaller. Like the rate of people who actually died in the Inquisition, at least in the Spanish Inquisition, was about comparable to the number of people who die on death row in Texas every year, which, again, we don't want to say that's nothing, but it isn't as if it's a reign of terror where people are, you know, running away from Texas Rangers because they're convinced they're going to be next. And so if our understanding is that it's like that, then it was a bad thing, but not at the level or scale or scope as the enemies of the church have claimed it to be or pretended it to be.
There was, however, the expulsion of the Jews in the year that America was, in 1492.
By Spain, by the Catholic Church.
Right, but by Catholic Spain. I mean, I'm not attributing that to the Catholic Church, but these things
are, I mean, this is a difficulty. The Jews were often badly treated in Catholic countries, but and also in an age in which heresy was viewed as a civil crime because it undermined the faith foundation of the state. That, you know, across Europe, there was this idea that if you believed a different thing, you were threatening the social order. And this was true, I think, in Christian countries and Muslim countries as well. So, yeah, in those contexts, that explains, it doesn't defend, but it explains kind of the context in which a lot of the ugly parts of that history happened.
Is that, do you have a follow-up, Bill? Did you want to ask another question?
Well, I just wanted to just add to that was that I've done my research, so I wouldn't necessarily excuse it as well. It wasn't that many people. And
How many people did you think that it was, out of curiosity, Bill?
I believe it's in the millions.
It's nowhere near that. Like a few thousand to maybe 30,000 is the upward estimate. So I'd be happy to recommend some resources on the Inquisition if you'd like. But the idea that millions of people, there were in many of the countries in Europe, only a few million people in the entire country. So a death toll in the millions just mathematically doesn't make any sense. I actually did an episode of Shameless Popery about this, if you're interested. Let me see if I can find the name of it. I think it was just called, like, Did the Catholic Church Kill Millions? Unfortunately, I can't find it immediately. But if you look up on YouTube, Shameless Popery, Millions of People, Inquisition, I think you should find it there.
You know what? We could, if Bill would like it, we could give him Chris Check's class on the Inquisition, if you'd like it. Thank you, Bill. I hope we'll talk again. That's actually a fascinating story, and I didn't know about it. It does make sense that there would be hidden Jews in New Mexico, given that New Mexico was at the extremes of the Spanish Empire at one time. But I don't know the story. I didn't know it at all before, Bill. So I hope we will get to speak again.
I found the name of it. I think it's just called Did the Catholic Church Murder the True Church? And then it's responding to Protestant claims that are very similar to the claims Bill's making. And touches on those claims as well in the course of it.
Bill, thanks. Got to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Jennifer says, behavior in the parking lot after Mass made me think twice about becoming a Catholic.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you. No doubt. Yeah, sure. I've often said I think the number one impediment to making an act of faith in the Catholic religion is Catholics.
Yeah.
Yeah, hands down. Yeah. We're a mess.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders this afternoon, 2 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Kevin in Salem, Oregon is...
I was going to actually add... I was able to find one of the historical accounts that I referenced before. So I mentioned I had that episode from like a year ago called Did the Catholic Church Murder the True Church? But in there, I talk a little bit about the Inquisition. And the British historian Henry Kamen talks about how a lot of our claims about the Spanish Inquisition are demonstrably wrong. And he goes through very methodically. I mean, the book is called The Spanish Inquisition. And he says at one point, taking into account all the tribunals of Spain up to about 1520, it is unlikely that more than 2,000 people were executed for heresy by the Inquisition. So if you've heard millions, 2,000 is quite a bit different than that. Now, look, that's still a problem. That's still bad. No one is saying 2,000 people is okay. But if you're imagining the Catholic Church was going around murdering like the entire population of Spain, which is what we'd be talking about if we're talking about millions, that's just a fictional thing. Like, you know, you're upset about an imaginary thing that didn't actually happen and couldn't have happened. Like, this would have been like World War I levels of carnage in an era where we're talking about very basic weapons. It'd be very difficult to even try to kill that many people. And thankfully, no one did. So I mentioned that just to hopefully contextualize that a little bit. And then maybe to add one second thing on top of that, which is a lot of the English-speaking world has these really exaggerated visions of what happened, particularly in the Spanish Inquisition, because England and Spain were for a long time fierce rivals of one another, religiously but also politically. And so there's what's called the Black Legend, which are all of these demonstrably untrue things that are being passed off as true about Spanish and Catholic history. And so if you've ever seen like the Iron Maiden or all of these medieval torture devices, virtually all of those were invented in the 19th century by people in the US or in the UK to imagine how bad Spanish people were and are, and how bad medieval people were. Well, how bad Catholics were.
In the 19th century in the U.S., probably it was the same case in Britain, these medieval torture museums actually made people a lot of money. So they invented, right. Like the Iron Maiden, it never existed in the Middle Ages. People will not believe you if you tell them that because
right.
Basically hucksters made so much money on these torture museums in the 19th century U.S. that it just became fact for many people.
There's no evidence of them ever being mentioned or referred to until the 19th century. And even then it was like, back in the day, they used to do this. And so you should treat it with exactly the same level of seriousness that you treat it when like ancient Greek historians like Herodotus explain how just over yonder, just past the people we know about, some of those people have dog faces as heads. And you're like, I don't think they did. I think you have a bunch of like weird stereotypes of people you've never met. Well, we have weird stereotypes of people we've never met called the people in the past.
Yeah.
And so it's very easy to imagine this very ridiculous version of history.
Yeah.
So I would point to that again, not to defend when bad things were done in the name of the church, because that is actually bad. But just to say a lot of the bad things people are really upset about literally didn't happen.
Again, thank you very much for the call, Bill. I hope we'll talk again. Kevin in Salem, Oregon, I made you wait twice listening on the great modern day radio. Kevin, go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, so I'm just thinking about Halloween, and of course it's candy and fun, but also it's not candy and fun. And I had to think of what I did myself as a teenager, how I would, we would destroy pumpkins that people had out front for decorations. We would paint the fences. We would throw rotten eggs at cars when they drove by. And I'm 66 now, but we did this as teenagers, you know, and we weren't the only ones doing it. No. Everybody else was.
But you had a change of heart after you got out of prison? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Here we are today. Here we are today in Kaiser, Salem, Oregon. And I go to the bar next door about 2 weeks ago, and there's 12 men and 12 women all dressed in Wiccan garb. And they were Wiccans. Mm. They weren't witches. They were Wiccans. And they were dressed up like, wow, you would have thought they were at a Halloween party. And then I noticed in my neighborhood, it's like, wow, even before October has arrived, the yards are being filled with graveyard headstones and skeletons. And it's all about death. You know, there's this incredible, could it be just candy? Yes, it could. But in reality, I don't think it is. And you just go into the stores and you look at, and all of the stores, the Halloween paraphernalia has increased incredibly. And I would say it's getting more incredible than Christmas. That's my opinion.
Okay, let me take maybe a few of those things at a time. Like, I don't think you should vandalize pumpkins. Your version of Halloween sounded a little, maybe it's because you're in Salem, and maybe Salem is a little wilder.
Did you grow up in Detroit by any chance? Because
Mischief Night.
The Detroit has a particular reputation for getting quite wild. But
well, that's on the night before Halloween, or if a sports team win or loses.
Okay, I'm not trying to pick on Detroit. It's just Detroit. You
night.
Have
that is a thing
you have
in
this
Detroit
reputation.
That's not a thing in the rest of the country, and that's October 30th.
Oh, okay,
it's actually a regional marker if you ever do the New York Times dialect quiz. Anyhow. Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, there are wicked ways to celebrate. Also, Wicca is a fake neo-pagan religion. What I mean by that is it's based on a pretend version of ancient Druidic religions that they had no written records. And so we don't know what they believed or practiced. And so in the 20th century, some historians actually basically just invented their own versions of what they thought it might have been like. And it was just kind of, I mean, it's historical cosplay when you know nothing about the actual evidence itself. Like, Wicca is not a real religion in any historic sense. It's just, I mean, if you've ever seen the Futurama episode where they have Vikings on the moon, because it's now been so long since the lunar landing, they don't know how it happened. It's that kind of thing all over again. We don't know what the ancient Druids actually believed, so we just make up some stuff and apply it to them and then claim we're doing the same thing. So I would say that's not a problem with Halloween, that's a problem with Wicca. And now they'll try to claim Halloween because they think it's an ancient Druidic or Celtic holiday called Samhain, but the response there is it's not. Like, if they claim Sunday because, well, it's the day of the sun, there's actually a stronger case to make for that, but Christians wouldn't be so insane as to say, let's get rid of Sunday then. And so I don't think the fact that pagans might try to claim a day means Christians should give it up without a fight. I think it's totally fine to fight for it. And then the last part about, well, I guess there's two last parts. You said there's a lot of candy and stuff being sold. I don't think that's paganism. I think that's capitalism. I mean, you can find Christmas stuff in like late August in places. That's not because people are incredibly devoted to the birth of Christ. That's because people want to sell stuff and make money on seasonal goods that they know when you're done with it, you're going to throw it away and have to buy it again next year. So I think that's just people making a buck. And then as for the focus on death, this again could be good or bad, because there is a way that focusing on death is actually spiritually healthy. Sirach 7, verse 36, says, "In all you do, remember the end of your life, and then you will never sin." And Thomas Kempis, in Imitation of Christ, talks about how at every day you should remember the fact that you might die today, and you should live your life accordingly. And so a focus on death, like, we live in a culture that's actually very forgetful of death. When people get old, we put them in places where, like, nursing homes and hospitals, where you don't see people getting old and dying. And as a result, we live in a world that has become dangerously forgetful of death and the fact that we'll stand before God and be judged for our actions. So in that sense, I think it's actually really healthy to reclaim what medieval Catholics called memento mori, remember your death. And so if you look at medieval Catholic artwork and even architecture, the Capuchins have a pretty famous church in Rome that is filled with artwork made out of skeleton, like real skeletons, like chandeliers and things out of bones. And the point of it was to make you mindful of the fact that you're going to die. That is actually a spiritually healthy attitude to have, not to be kind of like blasé about, but to realize like this is the human condition. You're mortal and I'm mortal. And we can forget that fact, but it's healthy to remember it.
Kevin, thanks. I'm sorry. The lines are still full and there's just a few minutes left. So let's go to Oklahoma where John is listening to EWTN on Channel 130 Sirius XM Satellite Radio. John, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hey, guys. Need to know about the Black Mass. Now, there's supposed to be a very large Black Mass being held in Atlanta on Friday. And they, from what I've been reading, they've been able to obtain a Eucharist.
Oof.
Yes. Now, this same thing tried to happen in Oklahoma City a few years back. And the Archdiocese sued and were able to get it back. Because they claimed it was stolen property. Do we know about this Black Mass, and is the Archdiocese in Atlanta, you know, taking action towards them? But really, what goes on in these Black Masses?
Yeah, so, okay, a few questions there. One is a fact-specific one. I don't know of any allegations that they have an actual host. Second, when we're talking about Satanism, you have, like, the Church of Satan, where there are people who actually are, you know, following Anton LaVey, and they're trying to worship the devil. This is a group called the Satanic Temple, which is mocking Christianity. They're atheists. And there's a guy named Lucian Greaves who's responsible for this. And so these are people who are trying to just make a blasphemous mockery of it without actually believing that the devil is real. Now, don't get me wrong, doing that is still a spiritual door to the occult and to the demonic. Like if I tear apart a famous painting because I'm convinced the painting isn't real, I'm still doing actual damage. So likewise, if you desecrate the Eucharist or if you offer prayers to Satan and everything else, that is still doing tremendous spiritual damage to yourself and others, whether you believe or not. Like your belief isn't what makes the devil real. And so if you're inviting the devil in, even if you're doing it just to be edgy and to show Christians how amazingly brave you are, it doesn't matter your motives. You know, so I would say I would respond to the movement that I know Catholics in Atlanta have been doing of going to adoration and making acts of reparation. I think that's the appropriate response. Like, don't give more publicity to someone who's obviously really hungry for attention in any way, shape, or form, because that's what this really is. Like, this is a guy who just really desperately wants to be noticed, and he's willing to go to any extreme to kind of get there, and just pray for him. Like, there's an obvious wounding there, and I think that I would kind of just leave it there. I don't think we need to give more fuel to his fire.
Right. And I know, unfortunately, in one part of Oklahoma City that I'm ashamed of is that our Capitol, we have a statue of Satan at the Capitol building that I'm just, it's like boggles my mind, the home of the blessed Stanley Rother, and we have this sitting up at our Capitol. It's like,
that's very unfortunate. They had that briefly in Iowa, but no more.
Yeah, it's people turning the freedoms that we have been given constitutionally into a kind of game to play rather than actually trying to respect one another. But I have to say, both sides play that game. I mean, there are religious people who are obnoxious in their behavior, and I wish they would stop as well. I'm going to name anybody on the air, but. You know, there are extremes of everything. I don't think most people want a statue of Satan around. I don't know, what would we call them? unhappy individuals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, jerks. All right. Okay.
Trying to think of something radio appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's remember our Lord. Maybe people could make a special visit to the Lord in the Eucharist and make reparation for that horrible thing that's being done. Joe Heschmeyer, I have to say goodbye. Thanks very much for two great hours. And for all the wisdom on Halloween. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.